Welcome to A World of Fragile Truths, a podcast by the knowledge platform Security and Rule of Law, where we unpack the latest evidence for our field, which show the assumptions under this sector's work are often fragile. My name is Christian Kuijten and today's latest evidence comes from our guest Marijke Schomeers from Buzara in Kenya, an organization that studies behavioral economics. Her recent book is called Lives Amidst Violence. It discusses our mental landscape because the many experiences, memories and emotions influence your decisions, your biases and what you think is fair or just. She describes the problem that Western peacebuilders, for example, often lack the understanding of such mental landscapes from people who experienced violence or poverty. And I'm also very happy to welcome our guest Nika Saidi, UNDP's global lead on mental health and psychosocial support in peacebuilding, a field where such understanding of mental realities is of course key. Yeah, welcome Nika and Marijke. Marijke and I already had the pleasure of meeting in The Hague, but you're calling from Kenya and Nika, not from New York.
From Uzbekistan, not far.
It's 8 o'clock over there, I understand. So I think we shouldn't drag this conversation out too long for you.
It's my pleasure. It's such an important topic, to be honest. And doesn't matter, it's 8 or 12.
Good to see the commitment. Yeah, well, let's dive into it. Marijke, why should a peace builder know about a mental landscape?
So the mental landscape is something that we developed in this research program. And it really started from a confusion, because one thing that we found, we were doing research in 8 conflict-affected countries. We did a number of surveys with people over the period of around 10 years, and we went back to the same people every single time and asked them questions about their lives, really, how they were surviving. And I don't necessarily just mean physically in terms of security, but how were they feeding themselves? How were they accessing services? What was their experience with the authorities around them? And one thing that was really confusing was that between round 1 and 2 in some of these surveys, we had measurably indicators that showed that the situation had improved. And yet when we asked them, how, you know, has your situation improved? Overwhelmingly, people said no, there hasn't been no positive change. And we could kind of see it, right? We knew that there were less security incidents. We knew that we could see that the roads had improved, that there were more schools being built and so on. And so that launched this question to say, why is it that actually people seem to not be able to experience that things are getting better for them? There is a landscape in which people experience their lives, which is this almost this mixing, and that's why the idea of landscape works really well, of many, many layers of experiences, of memories, of their own experiences in a conflict, of maybe the stories that they've heard from what happened to their grandparents, marginalization over generations and so on. And these many layers kind of form really the way in which people experience the world around them. And so if your mental landscape has been so shaped by this for many, many generations, it is very difficult to then say, but actually now we have better roads, so things are clearly becoming better. And that, to answer your question more directly, why is it important for peace builders to be aware of this? Because I think peace builders often assume that people are almost in a perfect position to engage with peace building programs. And in that they, with the best of intentions, sometimes ask them to be a little bit superhuman. They ask them to say, you know, now things are improving, forget about all the injustices, forget about all the past, engage with our program and things will improve. And I think the mental landscape helps us understand why some of these programs are really, really difficult for people to engage with.
So the experiences of those at concern are sometimes quite different from what peace builders expect. And Nika, you work with mental health and psychosocial support. First of all, can you maybe explain in 3 or 4 sentences what that is? And then also, yeah, do you also see these different layers that this mental landscape, let's say, emerging?
Yeah, that's a good question. So basically, to answer your first question, what is MHPSS or mental health psychosocial support? It's basically any type of local or outside support that aims to protect or promote psychosocial well-being, and in a better way to say is prevent or treat mental disorder. And the psychosocial basically emphasizes the relationship between psychological aspects of our experience and behavior and our relationships within a specific context, influenced by social, political, economic, and environmental factors. Because health does not exist in a vacuum. So as I was listening to Marijke, and she was, you know, sharing with us the survey and over the 10 years and the perceptions of security and improvement. And actually, very interestingly, I grew up in war myself. And I could relate to what Marijke was mentioning, that basically growing up on that conditions and seeing the people being, you know, lost to the war, children born out of war with a lot of challenges. I remember 10 years after that, when the war ended, I went to work in a country, and that country also was in a conflict zone. And then suddenly I heard a noise, and I grew up with biting my nail. And that's also one of the impacts of the war, of making me more nervous. And then suddenly, as I heard that noise, and I'm beating my nail again. So what Marijke was mentioning, that the experience that mm-hmm. has been carried forward, not at the individual level, but as a collective level, it lives longer than conflict and war.
Even between generations, I think that's also something that that you work with, but also Marijke is mentioned in your book, right? Can you maybe expand a bit on that? So it's not just the individual or the collective, let's say, that takes this trauma with them.
Mm. Yeah, these things have long arms. But what's also important for me is to make a real distinction between the notion of trauma and the mental landscape. And the reason why I make this point is because trauma, you know, is a wound, a cut that has been inflicted. Sometimes that can be one specific event. Sometimes that can be over a long period of time. But it requires very specific support for healing and for dealing with it. And that can, by all means, be part of the mental landscape. But the mental landscape is a bit looser, right? Because not every experience that I store in my brain as a memory needs to necessarily be like a wound or a trauma. Again, this is not something that I'm talking about other people doing this. We all do this because we all need a coherent story, and that explains why we are individually who we are and why we live in the world that we do. But to go back to your point and how this can trickle through generations, this, for example, if a group of people have for over generations experienced marginalization, it's not even necessarily that they've been subject to physical violence, but maybe structural violence, that becomes really part of their identity. It's very deeply infused. Even trying to then overcome this by, for example, improving the services, by building better hospitals in that part of the country, doesn't take away that really deeply ingrained understanding of my identity makes me a bit unwanted in this. And again, we've had that in research findings, where in parts of the country where measurably hospital access was improved, there were more hospitals that people could access. They still didn't feel satisfied with this, not because they didn't see that access had improved, but their experience of then taking up the services in the hospital was one of being mm-hmm. treated with disrespect. They weren't treated with in very good ways. And the only way they could make sense of this was to say, okay, I'm being treated in this way because I am part of this marginalized group, and the people who are providing these services now to me on behalf of the government are doing so very reluctantly because they don't actually want to give me the service. And some of these things, obviously, people will remember what their grandparents have told them. Our identity absolutely shapes how we experience the world around us. So it's not that surprising that this identity of having been marginalized will inform how you experience the world around you.
So something objective, let's say, on the surface as access to healthcare or justice might not already address all the smaller and bigger things that have shaped a mental landscape, and therefore you can't immediately expect certain changes. And as you mentioned, everybody has a mental landscape in the end. So it's also interesting that you mention how the different mindsets or different experiences and worldviews of peace builders, people from Western countries maybe, how they don't match very well with people who have lived amidst violence. How does that show? Can you maybe give an example of that, or Nika?
Sure. I actually, that's a very good segue to mention that the reason for UNDP, we come up with the better understanding of mental health and psychosocial support in peace building, was exactly for that reason. The sense of justice, the sense of rights, the intergenerational trauma and the collective memory raised around the challenges that people experience. It also creates a different sense of belonging. I cannot imagine getting to any concept, being it access to the livelihood and employment or, improving the well-being of community or perception of justice, that it can be done without looking at the impact that the landscape of mental well-being on people. But still, it's a concept that it comes in a very unequal circumstances. For example, in many parts of the world, in developing countries, concept of coaching, it's very accepted. But then we assume if we provide access to livelihoods, people just go and access the livelihoods and they thrive. We create leadership program, leadership for youth, leadership for women, and we assume, yes, the moment you create access, they should come. They don't realize the background. Yeah. There are many noise that is there that prevent access. So for me, the question is, and as you know, we're talking about the fragile truths. Do we understand equality and believe that every human being have the same right? And if we are challenged, and I'm so grateful that in one way, COVID opened the eyes of humanity to the importance of human in its full dimensions, the human and body and soul.
How did the COVID help with that?
COVID made us realize the importance of mental health issues.
Because of lockdowns? Or
yes, yeah, thank you. Yeah, because exactly, that's exactly when we have to be alone, disconnected from the normal settings we know, the normal habits, the normal environment, put us exactly like, for example, one IDPs would feel. Completely disconnected from their normal settings. Yeah, that's what I meant by COVID, not... Yeah, thank you.
Do you have anything to add before we take a break, Marijke?
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on a point that how you think of yourself and how deeply influential that is of how you make sense of the world around you. So one very common identity that programs, peacebuilding programs, often tell people they have is that they're conflict affected, right? But actually what we think this can do is that it kind of pushes people into an identity thinking corner that really influences how much they think they're able to do, and it influences how they make sense of the world. So an example was from the research done by our colleagues in Sri Lanka, where you had women who were kind of observing that there were a lot of pro-poor policies being implemented, and yet they couldn't see any benefit of them for themselves. And so then, of course, when you say, but this is supposed to benefit me, but it doesn't, why not? The way they made sense of that was because we are conflict affected, so maybe we are not part of this. And so all of a sudden, this framing of we are conflict affected and we are not part of this made them more and more alienated as the way of understanding themselves. And so these things have real kind of circular effects. And actually, maybe in a lot of programs that in a very well-meaning way say we're wanting to target the most vulnerable, very common way of thinking about this, do the exact opposite. And then I wanted to make one very quick other point. You asked earlier about how this might help peacefulness to think about this. So there's a really interesting thing about perceptions, right? Perception surveys are a very popular tool to understand whether particular programmatic approaches are working or to understand how people think of a problem. And then programs might commission a perception survey, and when they see that the perceptions are good, then they take them very seriously, right? And they say, this is helping our program is good. When perceptions aren't improving, when people are saying, no, we see no benefit of this program, two really tricky things happen, and both of them are very, very human. One is, even when people don't want to dismiss them, they kind of do, right? And they say, oh, well, people aren't understanding that this is actually good for them. What that shows us isn't that people are dismissive of other people's experiences, But it is kind of a pointer towards the mental landscape of the person implementing a program, right? Who are so steeped in a particular idea of what kind of programming must be beneficial to people, because that is their socialization, that is their experience, that is their beliefs, that they just simply cannot imagine that somebody else will not experience it in the same way. And once we put that out there, once we articulate it, I think it becomes actually a very creative conversation, and one that is a lot less judgmental than the language of kind of program evaluation and impact evaluation, you know, offers, which is, oh, well, your idea worked or
it didn't. So it's a very passive role you're almost imposing by saying the most vulnerable and then also deciding on what's best for them instead of trying to understand those realities. Well, let's definitely dive into ways to address these challenges after the break. But first, let's refresh our attention span a bit and listen to a voice note of someone else's experiences with today's topic.
My name is Mona Duale, Deputy Country Director, Interpeace Somali Programme. In the Somali context, mental health issues are often stigmatized within the society, and this stigma can be particularly damaging in the context of violence and conflict. Mental health and psychosocial support is also closely linked to human rights. Individuals and communities affected by violence and conflict have the right to access mental health and psychosocial support services and to be treated with dignity and respect. An important aspect of mental health as it relates to peace building is education and awareness raising. People affected by violence and conflict may not be aware of the services and resources available to them, or they may lack the knowledge and skills to access them. In summary, the issue of mental health is complex and requires a holistic approach across all sectors.
Thank you for contributing. Now, of course, identity plays a big role in conflicts and in, marginalization, like we just discussed, right? On religion, ethnicity, nationality, all kinds of ways your identity plays a role in there. But also, yeah, on a personal level, the many layers of identity shape how you see the world. So can you maybe dive a bit deeper in what role identity plays in your book, Marek?
Topic, what a topic, identity. So the way I try to grapple with this, so identity, I guess my starting point was that I realized that very often in programming, identity and targeting, that very ugly word targeting, becomes used in the same way. So you are a female who heads a household and there's no husband, you are holding the identity of female-headed household, hence we target you accordingly. The reason why this becomes really tricky is because what you think my main identity is and what I think my main identity is might really not be the same thing. So, you know, it speaks beside an identity. Maybe the female-headed household is perfectly fine with that, but has a problem with a legal issue and really needs some legal aid and doesn't necessarily need non-food items. And just as a last point on this, identity also in programming is often imagined to be quite fixed, right? As if there's just one. And if we go back to the idea of the mental landscape, things are, you know, the landscape have rivers and mountains and other horizons. And that's also what identity is like. It has many layers. It changes all the time. Your identity is fluid depending on whether you are experiencing yourself on a day as an individual or very strongly as part of your community. So all of these, of course, are important when you are dealing with understanding a conflict world and trying to figure out what programming might help in making situations better.
Yeah, so a bit too, let's say, gross generalizations are made when these categories are and the solutions for the problems that they are supposed to have are made. Although I can also imagine that it's going to be very hard to work without any categories. Do you work with the categories for MHPSS, Nika? Do you recognize that maybe people with mental health issues are then also addressed in a generic way sometimes?
Yes, in many ways. I mean, we view of victims. And that's a challenge. And I want us to open the conversation. I know you want to focus on identity, but it's very individualistic in its nature. So we have to put it in the context of the community. We are talking about the countries that are impacted by conflicts. And majority of this country have actually a very collective approach to life. Let's look at the role of the community in shaping the identity and helping also from a mental health and psychosocial support. And I want to focus on the psychosocial part. Because when a person is within their own community, there is a healing at the same time. Because there's a, although there is a collective remembrance of what has happened, and sometimes it's very painful, but you have someone to talk to. And then that's where you also demand accountability for the harm and the pain that has been caused either by true inequality, discrimination, persecution, or active war or violence. So there is a bit of a structure within community, and that's what we try to tap into. It gets more complicated when an individual has been removed from their own community and they are becoming and stand alone, and they desire, they try for finding actually a sense of someone helping them to remember how it feels to be part of the community. And sometimes they feel their story is the only solid story. And that's where the role of storytelling, the literature, the community centers, the celebration, ceremonies, that the fabric of community life come to existence. And that's also why it's important in the host communities that are receiving people who are displaced by any way or any means, that they also be able to be integrated in part of the natural settings of the community. Because that's how people manage to process some of the emotions, deal with that, and have also connection to what has happened previously to the previous generations, through support that we are providing, through peace-building efforts, we should look at more holistically that it's not only providing jobs or creating a better security sector, it has more dynamic into existence than just a very narrow, solo approach to peace-building. It has to be more comprehensive and holistic.
And there's a fantastic point there that you made, because on the one hand, stories are what allows us to survive, it allows us to function, it allows us to connect. And on the other hand, stories are also what stands or can stand in the way of change, right? Because once we have a narrative that is very deeply ingrained, it's very hard for us to change what we see. And that's an established phenomenon. Kahan calls this identity protective cognition. And what that means is that I will only take in the information that doesn't threaten my identity. It's kind of a human survival mechanism. And that is, on the one hand, beautiful because it kind of creates resilience. And on the other hand, it makes it very difficult for things to change. And again, I apply this to this kind of sector of peacebuilding programming. People as a sector and the individuals in it draw a lot of identity from doing peacebuilding work. And will be very protective of that identity when research information emerges that some of the approaches aren't working in a particular way.
And I guess that's also the difficult thing about it, right? We're talking about a sense of belonging, about, yeah, doing away with generalizing categories, about, let's say, long-term stories instead of just a quick service delivery that will change all of the sudden all the experiences of inequality. So, yeah, I still dare you to ask, like, okay, imagine I'm, let's say, a German policymaker involved in designing a peace-building program to build a trust between two communities. It's a very random example, but what should I do differently then?
Sure. No, I think I just wanted to answer your question, not looking at between two communities, but also looking at the community within larger framework. So if you allow me, you know, I work on actually prevention of violent extremism. We are all facing a more securitized world. We are all facing the civic space, the shrinking. There is less tolerance for different opinion. And then you're also challenged by a lot of online information being shared that are inciting hatred or challenging our assumption of truth. So we are dealing with the multi-layers of complexity when it comes to the narrative of what has happened. And many times, like coming even to the violent extremist group, are actually utilizing the lack of civic space, the lack of ability to exchange knowledge and share stories. And as we are trying, like Christian, your answer should be, to my view, how much we are creating a space for exchange of ideas with the fact, because the world is not in shortage of dialogue between the communities. But what is the shortage that will be bringing people to these spaces to have a dialogue? Are we aware of the with which perception these people coming? And not in every community, everyone have the same experience. So we are dealing with a very complex social phenomenon. And the only way is to have a much more prolonged discussion for dialogue and an ability to connect in different way, in many ways, and in not only one way. So not to come with one solution fit all, but being mindful of how each group and each community approach a dialogue and discussion and learning in different way.
Well, building on what you just said, Nika, I think for me what is really helpful is to, this may sound like a cliche, but give me time to unpack the cliche, to humanize this. Which
there's never time in a podcast.
Exactly. So, but the reason why I'm interested in behavior science is because it gives me a language to think through human mechanisms behind this. And so, for example, when you're designing a peace building program, a really useful way to then humanize this is to turn the mirror on yourself as the program designer and say, let me be really honest with myself here. What identity part of me am I trying to protect here with the way I think about this problem? Am I deep down really able and willing to listen to what I think people are saying the problem is?
What do you mean with protecting?
So, yeah, I mean, for example, if somebody says, can you please design a peace-building program that is appropriate to this context? It's not a context that you're familiar with, but you feel like a competent peace-building program designer from a different context, then you might want to protect your sense of expertise. So to then actually go into a new design process and say, but truly, is what I'm trying to do here appropriate in this context? Are the point that Nika made earlier, are some of the structures here, the deep running structures, so very different that the reason why I'm thinking of this particular program in a way is because I'm actually holding on to my identity as an expert. I don't want to feel incompetent. And I think that would be a really useful first step to not using the language of incompetence or lack of knowledge, but saying, no, actually, what is my human mechanism here that might stand in the way of doing something that is actually better than what I'm currently thinking?
A bit more modesty towards what you might not be so good at or what you need to improve. And Nika, you also mentioned then working less maybe on only services and more also on making space for a common understanding and sharing experiences of what happened and what is the problem and how can we solve it together. Less categories and more, let's say, self-categorization maybe. I've learned a lot today, but I'm curious also to hear lastly from you. What are you taking away from this conversation before we round off?
So for me, one point that Nika made, and we didn't have enough time to linger on it enough, is this issue of trust. And that trust is really crucial. It's the backbone of a lot of things, but it's also incredibly fragile. It's very, very fleeting. And very often, I think we think of trust as something that is built, that can be the result of a trust-building exercise. And we spend little time on some of the things that we discussed earlier of how your own understanding of who you are, your identity, relates to what you can trust, who you can trust. It is me trusting something or someone. Yeah. And unless I understand what part of me that is that allows this trust to happen, that trust will continue to be very, very influenced by outside factors.
Nika, you want any last conclusion?
Yeah, actually, very interestingly, as a person who believe in the sharing of history and revealing and more community life, I like what Marijke mentioned, that which a story, actually. And sometimes the stories is the one that keep us in the shadow. And, you know, it's also true about the gender issues. Now we are realizing one of the challenges that we are facing in terms of moving and embracing gender equality. It's embedded in all the stories that we have heard. And how we are actually creating a more space that to be able to see a truth from a different point of view. It's to enhance the ability to consult and talk together in a way that we are seeking the truth.
Oh, I think we went pretty deep actually today, and touched upon a topic that we didn't touch upon before in this podcast. So I'm really happy, and also happy to hear that you all got something out of this as well. And hopefully you, our dear listener, also gained some new insights and feel like you have one less fragile truth to deal with. We'll see each other next month.